Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Judges chapter 5. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 31. This is the Song of Deborah and Barak. Our context is this. In chapter 4, the prophetess and judge Deborah and the general Barak has just clobbered one of the enemies of Israel, namely the Canaanite Jabin, who was king of a city called Hazor, right south of Lake Hula in northern Israel. And they whopped up on him big time. Killed Sisera, remember, Jael drove the tent peg through the Canaanite general Sisera's brain. So we start now in Judges 5, verses 1 through 2. Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, that the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered, bless the Lord. Now, by the way, sometimes this song, in fact, most often it's called the Song of Deborah, but notice in verse 1 it's then Deborah and Barak sang on that day. So this is the Song of Deborah and Barak. Now, Deborah is mentioned first. Here's perhaps some reasons why she had the most to do with rousing the people to fight. Maybe she was the one who took the lead in composing the song. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says she was the sole author. I don't know how they say that, because it says right here in verse 1, then Deborah and Barak sang on that day. I guess Barak's just doing the singing, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and Deborah just did all the composing. The ESV header has the Song of Deborah and Barak, which sounds like Barak helped compose it, according to their opinion. But at any rate, this song was sung. Now, let me give you some literary introduction to the song. This is stuff that usually, when I was in English class in high school, I hated all this stuff, but I'll quote some introduction material about this song. Let's start with John Gill. Quote, the following divine hymn or song, penned by Deborah under divine inspiration, as the sublimity of the style, the fine and noble thoughts and sentiments that are in it, the beautiful and elegant phrases in which they are expressed, abundantly show no Sappho or any Grecian poetess, nor indeed any poet whatever, uninspired, being equal to the writer of this poem. High praise indeed. Now here's Adam Clark quoting another commentator of his era named Kennicott. Quote, some parts of it are at present very obscure, and we'll see as we go through there's some difficulties, and others are unintelligible in our English version. That's why I'm not going to use the KJV. Besides particular difficulties, there's a general one that pervades the whole, rising, as I humbly apprehend, from its being considered as entirely the Song of Deborah. It is certain, though very little attended to, that it is said to have been sung by Deborah and by Barak. I just read that in verse 1. It is also certain that there are in it parts which Deborah could not sing, as well as parts which Barak could not sing, and therefore it seems necessary, in order to form a better judgment of this song, that some probable distribution should be made of it, whilst those words which seem most likely to have been sung by either party should be assigned to their proper name, either to that of Deborah the prophetess or to that of Barak the captain. Here's an example. Judges 5:12. Awake, awake, Deborah. Awake, awake, sing a song. Well, now Deborah's not going to be calling upon herself to sing a song. That would be Barak singing that. And then the last part of the verse, arise, Barak, and take away your captives. Well, Barak's not going to be singing that song. That would be Deborah singing to Barak. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, Adam Clark also says it seems probable that Jael in this song, it's improbable that she should be styled blessed above women for the death of Sisera, because Clark thinks that Jael was a murderess for doing what she did. I don't know. We've talked about that in the last audio. I believe that she should be a hero. It was a military stratagem that she did by giving him that warm milk, welcoming her into her tent with that sacred zone of hospitality right before she drove the tent peg through his brain. Hey, war is hell. But anyway, Clark doesn't see it that way. But at any rate, I think he's right, though, that the song is composed by two different people, and so we've got to take note of that as we go through. Verse 2 says, the leaders led in Israel. This is the song now. This is the start of the song. That the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered. Notice you've got to have leaders, and you've got to have followers, volunteers to follow the leaders if you're going to get any battle won. That's a good application point for the church today. Let me back up just a little bit and give you some more introduction material from Adam Clark, quoting a Dr. Hales of his era. Dr. Hales observes that the design of this beautiful ode, which breathes the characteristic softness and luxurious of female composition, seems to be twofold, religious and political. I guess Dr. Hales assumes only Deborah wrote it, Barak didn't have anything to do with it. So here's the purpose. First, to thank God for the recent victory and deliverance of Israel from Canaanitish bondage and oppression, and next, to celebrate the zeal and alacrity with which some of the rulers volunteered their services against the common enemy, and to censor the lukewarmness and apathy of others who stayed at home and thus betrayed the public cause. And by this contrast and exposure, to heal those fatal divisions among the tribes so injurious to the commonwealth. The first verse, as a title, briefly recites the design or the subject of the poem, which consists of 8 stanzas. Well, so the introduction here in verse 2, that the people volunteered, she's praising those who did volunteer. We'll see as we get into the song that she's going to condemn those who didn't volunteer. Sort of gives us the overall theme of the song. We go now to verses 3 and 5 in Judges 5. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I, to the Lord, I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. This is either Deborah singing. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth quaked, the heavens also dripped. Even the clouds dripped water. The mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord. This Sinai, at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel, I'm going to break it off there. She appeals to the kings. Hear, O kings, give ear. Which kings is she talking about? It could be those who came with Jabin to fight against Israel. There's no mention of such, but it's quite probable that there were some kings who fought with Jabin. Could be some neighboring kings who didn't fight with Jabin, but they were just lookers on. Could be all the kings of the earth give ear. This is a poem. It could be all the kings of all time, not only the kings back then, but all the kings forever and ever and ever. Well, you know, poetry. Things are sort of loose there. But at any rate, the kings are supposed to give ear to this song of praise to the Lord, the God of Israel, Yahweh. Deborah wants the high and mighty of this world to know there's one greater than them. In verse 4, she says, Lord, when you went out from Seir. Now, Seir is that mountain range just to the east of the Arabah Valley that runs from the Dead to the Red Sea. That, of course, is where the Edomites ended up, the descendants of Esau ended up taking Mount Seir. So why is Deborah mentioning Mount Seir here? Lord, when you went out from Seir, you marched from the field of Edom. Of course, Edom is Seir. The Seir mountain range belonged to Edom. What is she referring to? Well, she could be referring to the giving of the law, as Adam Clark suggests. God came to Sinai from the east, like the rising of the sun. So as you look to the Seir mountains, as you're standing at Mount Sinai, you see the sun coming up, and then it comes over Mount Sinai. This is poetry. Sometimes people disagree on how to interpret poetry. This reference to Seir could refer to the time when the Israelites had conquered Edom. They had marched from Edom up toward the land of Canaan, where they, on the east side of the Jordan River, where they fought with the Amorites, King Sihon and King Og. So it could be, Lord, when you went out from Seir, in other words, when the Israelites, when you, God, being in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies, as the tabernacle was carried through the mountains of Seir up to the south of Moab and then up into Moab when the Israelites beat Sihon and Og, the Amorites, who were in charge there at the time. When that happened, the earthquake, the heavens dripped. Well, before we start talking about earthquakes and heavens dripping, dripping is a terrible translation in my humble opinion. That's the NASB. The Holman Christian Study Bible has poured. The heavens poured. That's a much better translation to describe a storm, because this storm and earthquake here is symbolic of God's judgment. And if it's talking about Sinai, that fits, because the law brings judgment. Or if it's talking about conquering Moab, or conquering Sihon and Og, the Amorites who were in Moab and Ammon, well, then that fits too, because it's judgment coming. So let's read it this way. The earth quaked, the heavens also poured, even the clouds poured water. The mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord. This Sinai at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel. And I, you know, there's a mention of Mount Sinai right there, so it makes me think that the option of what this is the sunshine coming over Mount Seir, going over Mount Sinai, and then all this earthquake stuff is referring to the signs that were accompanied with the giving of the law and judgment. And, of course, the point of that allusion is judgment came upon Jabin, the king of Hazor. We go now to Judges 5, verses 6 through 7. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted, and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry ceased, they ceased in Israel, until I, Deborah, arose, until I arose, a mother in Israel. Now, Shamgar was the last judge that was mentioned before Deborah. That's in Judges 3, verse 31. After him, that means after Ehud, After him, Ehud, came Shamgar, the son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. So in those days, which were the days of Shamgar and the days right after that, which would be the days of Deborah, the highways were deserted. Why? Because of robbers. Law and order had broken down. Travelers went by roundabout ways to avoid the robbers. Verse 7, the peasantry ceased. The NIV has village life in Israel ceased, that which makes more sense. In other words, agriculture was interrupted. The people were obliged to gather together in fortified places to protect each other against spoilers and intruders. I think we'll see that when we get to Gideon. And so Deborah arises in the midst of this anarchy. Sounds like America. People in the big cities are hunkering down, begging their idiotic mayors and city councils to hire some more police that they just fired so that people don't get shot in their homes. And so Deborah arose, a mother in Israel. That phrase, mother in Israel, referring to that, John Gill says this, quote, a nursing mother to Israel, to teach and instruct them in the mind and will of God, to administer judgment and justice to them, to protect and defend them, and in all which she discovered, a maternal affection for them. We go now to Judges 5, verses 8 through 9. New gods were chosen, Deborah continues. Then war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people. Bless the Lord. Again, there's commanders, that's the leaders, volunteers, those are the followers. You can't win any battle without leaders and followers. You can't do anything in church without leaders and followers. To make an application point there, new gods were chosen, that just means Israel went idolatrous during the time of the judges. Here's four scriptures showing that, Judges 2:11. Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Baals, the sun god, came from the Lebanese coast, Phoenicia, but Baals were everywhere, all over the ancient Near East. Judges 2:13, so they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth, or the Asherim. Astarte, the female goddess, the many-breasted one with full of breast showing her fertility, the goddess to whom people gave Easter eggs to, Astarte eggs, they painted colorful eggs and gave to her. Judges 3:7, the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth. Judges 17:1 through 5, this is one of the appendices. Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, let me summarize this. He stole 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother, gave them back. Mother said, praise the Lord, I'm going to praise God, i.e. the pagan God. I'm going to make a graven image and a molten image from 200 pieces of this 1,100 pieces of silver that you return. And she went to a silversmith and got a graven image and a molten image made. And then Micah made a shrine and made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become a priest. Now that's idolatry big time. Got your own private religion going. Now verse 8 is a little bit obscure. The end of it, not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Not a shield or a spear. Well, what does shield or not a shield or a spear mean? Well, here's some options. It could mean that the 40,000 that are mentioned here were negligent and slothful in not providing themselves with arms. Or it could mean the 40,000 were cowards. They had arms, but they refused to pick them up. Or it could be the 40,000 were disarmed by the Philistines and the Canaanites and were beaten somewhere. Well, that leaves a lot of options. Well, let's move on to the next phrase. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Who were these 40,000? Well, now, Israel had several hundred thousand soldiers on the west side. I'm thinking maybe the six tribes who fought in this battle, there are only six tribes that fought, namely Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh, Zebulun, Issachar, and Naphtali. Maybe they only had 40,000. I don't know. That's just my speculation. Well, here's some other options as to who these 40,000 refer to that didn't have a shield or a spear. Option number one, there's no need of a shield or a spear among the 40,000 children of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. These are the eastern tribes who came over the Jordan to the west when they helped the Israelites out because God fought for them. Now that option assumes that Deborah's not talking about the battle with Jabin, king of Hazor. That's talking about previous conquest under Joshua. And I don't believe that. I believe Deborah's going to stick to the knitting here to talk about the battle that Barak just won. So I don't like that option. Option number two, John Gill, this refers to 40,000 Benjamites killed in the famous Civil War. This is again in an appendix of Judges 20. Gill says this happened before the times of Deborah because the appendix is out of time order. Judges 20, verse 21, then the sons of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and fell to the ground on that day 22,000 men of Israel. Judges 20, verse 25, Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah the second day and fell to the ground about 18,000 men of the sons of Israel. You add the 22,000 of verse 21 to the 18,000 men of verse 25 of Judges 20, and you come up with 40,000 Israelites wiped out by the Benjaminites. Well, maybe, but that's not speaking to the immediate purpose of that hymn, so I have trouble with that option too, that option also. Here's option number three from John Gill, quote, though the number of the Israelites was several hundred thousands, yet there were not to be seen among them shields and spears sufficient for 40,000. Well, that's reasonable. That's referring to the battle at hand. You got all these people, only 10,000 went, as we see in chapter 4. But there were 40,000 people there, didn't pick up a shield or a spear, so only 10,000 went. Remember now, the theme of this song is praise for those who went and obloquy on those who didn't go. So that's a pretty good option, I think. Here's my option. That was John Gill's option number three. This is my suggestion, option number four. The 40,000 did not pick up weapons. Only the 10,000 who fought with Barak did pick up weapons. I like that, even though I haven't found another commentator who's backed me up on that. But at any rate, it's a little bit obscure. But the point is that there was a lot of people that didn't fight in this battle, and Deborah's not happy. But she is happy, verse 9, to the commanders of Israel. That's the leaders of the tribes that went out, the six tribes that went out, and the volunteers, the people who followed them. We go now to Judges 5, 10 through 12. Deborah continues, or Deborah and Barak, Deborah and or Barak. You who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who travel on the road, sing. At the sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places, there they shall recount the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his peasantry in Israel. Then the people of the Lord went down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and take away your captives, O son of Abinoam. Now in verse 10, Deborah addresses those who ride on white donkeys. Who are they? Maybe they're the princes and nobles in Israel. Maybe they're merchants on business. They're no longer afraid to travel, take those roundabout roads because the robbers had infested the roads. I like that option. If it's referring to princes and nobles in Israel that are supposed to sing here in joy, rich carpets that are mentioned here in verse 10, you who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets. Well, that sounds like merchants sitting on their rich carpets, which is laid across the back of the white donkey. But rich carpets is translated in the KJV as judgment, you who sit in judgment. So that would refer to rulers of Israel. Either way it works. I suppose the word is hard to translate. The reason they're said to be white donkeys is because white donkeys are relatively rare and valuable. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen one. Most of the ones I see are sort of dark gray. Now, some countries considered it dishonorable to ride upon an ass or a donkey. And I'm not going to get into the difference between a donkey, a jinny, a henny, and an ass. And there's all kind of words that drive you crazy. I tried that one time, decided to give up on that. But at any rate, it was okay to ride on a donkey back then because there were no horses. Judges 10:4, he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. And that shows, and they had 30 cities. So that means 30 leaders of cities had 30 donkeys. That means they were big shots. So riding on a donkey was a good thing, not a bad thing. Judges 12:14, he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. That's a good thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be mentioned to show their power and their authority. They were riding on a donkey. Verse 10 mentions you who travel on the road. Of course, the road's open now because the bandits are put down because of the victory over Jabin. And because of a victory over Jabin, I guess that also intimidates the robbers, knowing that there is now an army to take care of these people. Verse 11, at the sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places. Well, the sound of those in verse 11, that could be translated in the King James, the noise of archers at the watering places. The NIV has the voice of the singers at the watering places. The NIV margin has the warriors at the watering places. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. The point is where you gather the sheep to water them. That was a place of conversation and social gathering and so forth. And the people there be watering their flocks, and they're so happy they're going to be singing songs. Recounting the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his peasantry in Israel. And watering places used to be a favorite haunt of robbers because robbers would go to those watering places and rob people who were there, but not anymore. There's going to be singing instead of robbery going on. Then the people will go down to the gates because now justice is available to the people because we've got, instead of anarchy, we've got judges, leaders of the nation, judging like they're supposed to and carrying out justice. We go to verse 12. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. And Barak, arise, Barak, take away your captives. Well, now that's interesting, captives. If you recall from chapter 4, I don't have the verse in front of me, but I just did the audio yesterday, and I remember very well that there was not a man left of Sisera's army except Sisera himself. So how could there be captives? Well, here's some ways to reconcile that. Jabin's men had some people left. Sisera lost all of his men, but maybe Jabin had other divisions of his army out there fighting. In fact, Adam Clark suggested that exactly, that's what happened, as we'll see in a minute. Or it could be other nations or tribes might have joined in with Jabin as allies, and they got beat in the battle, and so slaves were taken with them. So that's not really a problem. We go to Judges 5, verses 13 through 14. Then survivors came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came down to me as warriors. Now this is assuming the me is Deborah here. From Ephraim, those whose root is in Amalek, came down, following you, Benjamin, with your peoples. From Machir, commanders came down, and from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office. Now this is one of those obscure places that Adam Clark was talking about. So let's look at several of these terms here. First of all, survivors came down to the nobles. John Gill says that these survivors were the people of Israel that had been under the yoke of Jabin. They came down to the nobles, the leaders of Israel, and say, well, the survivors came to the nobles. I suppose that means that the volunteers, that, well, I suppose it means the survivors of the battle, the survivors of that battle came down to the nobles and said, look here, leaders, we won the battle, I think. Now, the phrase, they came down to the nobles, verse 13, in the NASB, it has, they came down to me as warriors. Now, here's some other options as to the correct reading of that phrase, came down to me as warriors. The King James says, the Lord made me have dominion over the mighty. And that would be over the mighty of Canaan or the mighty of Israel. In other words, Deborah's saying, I win. Or Barak is saying, I win. The Holman Christian Study Bible has it, the Lord's people came down to me with the warriors. Now, that would refer to the 10,000 soldiers of Barak who came to Kadesh, which is 4 miles northwest of Lake Hula there, to muster their forces with Deborah. That's all in the last chapter. So the Lord's people, the 10,000 of Naphtali and Issachar, Zebulun, they came down to me at Kadesh. And I assume the down would refer to the fact that Kadesh is lower than the surrounding hill country. The Septuagint, as option number 3, translates it as, the Lord's people came down for him with the warriors, which would mean that the 10,000 soldiers of Barak came to Kadesh to muster with Barak, with him, Barak, instead of with Deborah. In other words, if the pronoun is they came to me, would be coming to Deborah. If they came with him, it would be, or came for him, it would be for Barak. So you got pronouns translated differently, and it's just the biggest mess, I'd say. Let's just say the 10,000 came to Deborah to fight. Cut the Gordian knot on that difficult verse. Now, verse 14, it gets even worse. 14, from Ephraim, those whose root is in Amalek came down. Now, see, Deborah is praising the volunteers here, and she starts with Ephraim. They came down, assuming that means the soldiers came to help the soldiers who were mentioned in chapter 4, Naphtali, Issachar, and Zebulun, but he also got some from Ephraim also. Well, that's easy enough. But this little phrase, Ephraim whose root is in Amalek, oh boy, that's a tough one. So we need to look at some options as how does Ephraim have its roots in Amalek? Option number 1 from John Gill, a detachment was sent against Amalek from Ephraim. Ephraim who has his roots in Amalek, and then that means Ephraim was rooted in Amalek in order to beat him. Now, that depends on the King James translation, which has in translated as against. So it reads in verse 14, from Ephraim, those whose root is against Amalek came down. And, of course, Amalek would be assumed to be in league with Jabin. Option number 2, because Joshua, who was an Ephraimite, destroyed the Amalekites at Rephidim. That was long ago at the beginning of the Exodus. Why? But the trouble with option number 2 is why would Deborah be bringing up such a long time ago event? I don't think so. Here is option number 3 offered by the commentator Joseph Benson, mid-19th century guy. Quote, this translation is very obscure, and therefore it might be better rendered and more agreeably to the Hebrew. Out of Ephraim came down those who were planted or whose rest was in Amalek. Meaning some of the tribe of Ephraim who were settled in or about the Mount of Amalek. Well, of course, I don't know where the Mount of Amalek is. Amalek was down to the south. Why would they be up in Ephraim? So I don't know. Option number 4. Amalek should be translated in the valley. The Septuagint actually does translate it that way, in the valley, according to the Holman Christian Study Bible note at this place. And this would be some unknown valley where the Ephraimites came from. And I like that one because it doesn't tie you down to having to explain too much. From Ephraim, those whose root is in the valley, some valley that Deborah knew about, they came. Following you, Benjamin, with your peoples. Now, when did the Benjamites help Deborah? We don't have an explicit statement that says that that happened, but it's a reasonable supposition. Now, some people say that Deborah is referring to 1 Samuel 15:1 through 9, when Saul and his tribe of Benjamin sent 200,000 soldiers and destroyed Amalek, which means that Deborah would have to be prophesying here because that was in the future. John Gill says that Benjamin went out to prevent Amalek giving assistance to Jabin, and the Ephraimites followed and assisted that. I don't think so. It's just to say that the Benjaminites went out with Deborah to fight Jabin. Then from Machir, commanders came down in verse 14. Machir was the oldest son of Manasseh, and of course we're talking about West Manasseh here on the west side of the Jordan River, especially since Judges 5:17 suggests strongly that the eastern half of Manasseh gave no assistance in this battle. Judges 5:17, Gilead remained across the Jordan. Now, Gilead, of course, is Reuben, Gad, and East Manasseh. And so all of Gilead remained across the Jordan. One more obscure reference in these two verses. Verse 14 says, and from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office, they came. Well, the important thing is that they came and they helped. But the incidental detail that they wield the staff of office is a little bit obscure. First of all, the translation is obscure. The King James has it, who wield the pen of a writer, but there's no evidence that Zebulun ever had any noted novelists or poets. I'm just joking about the novelists, of course, or analysts or historians, and none of that. Ellicott translates it this way, those who lead with the staff of the marshal. I think that makes more sense because now you're talking military. Those who wield the staff of a marshal, those who come with military expertise to help Barak out. We go now to Judges 5, verses 15 through 16. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As with Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. Among the division of Reuben there was great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? Question mark. Among the divisions of Reuben there were great searchings of heart. Now this is another two verses that are difficult. So let's start with verse 15. The princes of Issachar, of course, that assumes that the whole tribe is coming behind the princes. If you look at the map, you got Naphtali right to the west of the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula, and then you go south of Naphtali into the Kidron Valley is Issachar, and then you go up the Kidron Valley going back toward Carmel is Zebulun. Into the valley, that's the Kidron Valley right there. We talked all about the geography in the last audio. And so that's not difficult. But now it says, among the divisions of Reuben, there was great resolves of heart. That's the NASB translation. Well, what are the divisions, first of all? A couple of options. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the divisions of Reuben refer to the watercourses which descend from the eastern hills, that was in Moab, into the Jordan and the Dead Sea. If you recall, Reuben took the former territory of Moab on the east side of the Jordan River, from the Arnon River in the south to Heshbon in the north, the city of Heshbon, and there were watercourses that descended out of those hills, and that's what is being talked about here. Or, as Adam Clark says, it refers to the divisions of opinion in Reuben. Should we go or should we not go? So it's hard to say which of those two options the divisions refers to. Now, Reuben is mentioned here by name. This commences the list of the five tribes who did not fight with Deborah. These five tribes were Reuben, Gad, East Manasseh, Dan, and Asher. There were six tribes who were mentioned: Benjamin, Ephraim, West Manasseh, Zebulun, Issachar, and Naphtali. That's six. Judah and Simeon are not involved in this one way or the other. They are not condemned, probably because that's so far away that Deborah would not really expect them to come help. Now, among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as they were great searchings of heart. Now, here's some options as to what is the correct reading and the correct meaning of this phrase. Option number one, in Reuben there was a division of opinion. This is according to Colin Delitch. Some wanted to go, some did not want to go. So, under that scenario, divisions means divisions of opinion, and great resolves of heart is great searchings of heart. Searchings is much better than resolves. Resolves like it sounds like you decided which way you're going to go, which there's no division of opinion. We've already decided. So that's, I don't like the NASB translation. Let's say it's the great searchings of heart, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it. Well, that's reasonable. Another option is what these searchings of heart were, searchings of the heart. The Western Israelites bemoaned the fact that Reuben didn't come to help. So this option depends on a KJV translation. Verse 15 would be translated this way. For the divisions of Reuben, there were great thoughts of heart. For the divisions of Reuben. Not among the divisions of Reuben, but for. Again, these prepositions are always hard to translate. And so that would mean the Western Israelites were thinking about in their heart, searching in their heart, how come these Reubenites didn't come help us? I don't know. I like Colin Delitzsch's idea that there was a big division of opinion amongst the Reubenites. And so Deborah commences to criticize them at verse 16. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? In other words, instead of getting ready for war, you're sitting there listening to the shepherds' pursuits out here in the sunshine and the breeze, pursuing domestic pursuits at ease in your homeland. Now, of course, that assumes the translation of among the divisions of Reuben, not for the divisions of Reuben. There were great resolves, great searches of heart, and hearing of piping for the flocks. So we go down to Judges 5, verses 17 and 18. Gilead remained across the Jordan, and why did Dan stay in ships? Asher sat at the seashore and remained by its landings. Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death, and Naphtali also on the high places of the field. Now, Gilead, of course, refers to that area east of the Jordan River. Gilead, just a short way of referring to it. And here, Adam Clark says that the Song of Deborah is referring to the tribe of Gad, which is between the northern tip of the Dead Sea up to the Jabbok River there, former Ammon. They stayed across the Jordan, so they get criticized. Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that Deborah is referring to Gad and East Manasseh, which is a little bit is north of Gad and goes up east of the Sea of Galilee in Bashan. And I say, well, why not Gad, East Manasseh, and Reuben being referred to? Because Reuben was part of Gilead. They had a piece of Gilead, the southern end of it, the eastern side of the Jordan River Valley from the Dead Sea, from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. That was Gilead, and Reuben had part of it. Could be because Reuben was already mentioned. But anyway, you put all that together, and Deborah has criticized East Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, all of them. And then she takes out on Dan. And why did Dan stay in ships? Well, the original allocation for Dan, of course, was right around Joppa, which was a port. Let's see what Clark says about that. Quote, the words of Deborah imply a criminal neglect on the part of the Danites. They were intent upon their traffic and trusted in their ships. Joppa was one of their seaports. Joppa, of course, is where present-day Tel Aviv is, on the coast of the Mediterranean. And also, Deborah picks on Asher. Asher sat at the seashore. Remember, Asher is to the west of Naphtali. Naphtali is to the west of the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula, kind of a long strip of land. And Asher is on the Mediterranean coast. And so that's what seashore refers to there. Asher sat at the seashore. Sounds like they're taking a trip to the beach. They could have easily come to the aid of Barak because they're close by. They didn't do it. They sat on the Mediterranean seashore, remained by its landings, the place where ships come in. Now, verse 18 says, Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death. Now we're going back to praising the people. Zebulun is in the Kidron Valley, south of Asher. This is the first tribe as you go from Mount Carmel down the Kidron Valley, the Valley of Jezreel. And they despised their lives even to death because they fought. And Naphtali also, those two tribes, of course, they were close by. They helped Barak out the most. And they despised their lives even to death on the high places of the field. That's probably referring to the top of Mount Tabor. Josephus, if you recall from the last audio, said there was a 3-mile flat plain surrounded by a wall on the top of Mount Tabor. But anyway, that's where Barak, he came down from Kadesh, his hometown. And after he gathered his 10,000 troops and he came down south and he went to Mount Tabor, which is on the at the southwestern end of the Jezreel Valley, on the northern side of it, at the intersection of Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar. And he went to the top there with all his troops, and then he charged down from the top of Mount Tabor into the Jezreel Valley and wiped out the army of Sisera. So that's probably what Deborah's referring to here, the high places of the field, talking about Mount Tabor. We go now to Judges 5, verses 19 through 22. The kings came and fought, then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach, near the waters of Megiddo. They took no plunder and silver. The stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. O my soul, march on with strength. Then the horse's hoofs beat from the dashing of his valiant steeds. Verse 19 says, the kings came and fought. That would be the kings who helped Sisera, probably. And kings is more like kinglet, people who were in charge of a city. They fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach. If you will look at the Valley of Jezreel on the map, Taanach is right south of Megiddo, which is sort of in the middle of that valley. As you go in northwest to southeast down the valley from Carmel to the Jordan River Valley, Megiddo's in the middle. That's, of course, the famous place where the so-called Battle of Armageddon is supposed to take place at the end of the world and wipe everybody out, but I don't believe that. But that's where Megiddo is. Taanach is right south of Megiddo. Now, Taanach belonged to Manasseh. Manasseh, of course, runs right up to the southern edge of the Jezreel Valley. But even though Taanach belonged to Manasseh, it was located in the tribal boundaries of Issachar, which is kind of interesting how you got cities that aren't in their own tribal boundaries. Here's what Clark says, quote, it is conjectured that Jabin and his confederates had invaded Manasseh, as both Taanach and Megiddo were in that tribe, and they were discomfited by the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali at Taanach and Megiddo, while Barak defeated Sisera at Mount Tabor. In other words, Clark speculates that there was a division of forces, and there were other forces that knocked out Taanach and Megiddo, where Barak beat Sisera at Mount Tabor. We're not going to worry about that because that's all conjecture. The point is the Israelites whooped the Canaanites, made them sorry they got up in the morning. Now these kings of the Jabinites, of the Canaanites, those who fought with Jabin, they took no plunder in silver. What does that mean? Well, that could mean that the allied kings of Jabin didn't take any pay from Jabin. Or it could mean that the allied kings of Jabin expected much booty in an anticipated rout of the Israelites, but they got nothing because there was no rout of the Israelites. They lost. So they took no plunder. I think that's the easiest solution. Some people say that they took no plunder refers to the Israelites. They fought for liberty, not for plunder. They're not in it for filthy lucre. They didn't take any plunder from the Canaanites that just killed them. Well, that's nice, but I don't think that's what it means. It sounds like the Canaanite kings took no plunder in silver because they got whooped. Verse 20, the stars fought from heaven. Now, the stars fought from heaven, that could refer to angels. In other words, even the angels of the mighty host of God are fighting for the Israelites. Could be, or it could be referring to the star, you know, typical stars that we know about that shine at night. Jogili suggests the battle maybe was fought at night and the starlight helped the Israelites. That's a stretch, but John Gill is good at that. From their courses, they fought Sisera. Maybe it's referring to the fact that stars are said to be in the ancient world in charge of events. And maybe one of the events was a big thunderstorm that came and wiped out the army of Sisera. Josephus says that that's exactly what happened. A big thunderstorm wiped them out, and all this reference to thunderstorms and rains that we just mentioned. And here, and the Kishon Brook is going to be swollen, the ancient torrent. The torrent makes me think that there was a big thunderstorm, and people might have thought there might be an allusion to the fact that stars are controlling the weather. That's my speculation. Now, the Kishon River, which was running right down the center of the Valley of Jezreel there, right, had its headwaters at Mount Tabor, where the battle between Barak and Sisera took place. That torrent started there, and here's what John Gill says about that, quote, many of Sisera's soldiers, in their confusion, endeavored to make their escape by fording or swimming over the river by which they were swept away and drowned. And I think that's a quite reasonable speculation. Now, the torrent of the Kishon River is said to be ancient. The ancient torrent, that could refer to the fact that the river was not cut on by any art of man, any technology. It existed from all creation, that river. Or it could be the ancient torrent. It was ancient because it was spoken of by poets in ancient times. Verse 21 mentions the dashing of horses' hooves, dashing of valiant steeds. Remember, Jabin had 900 chariots pulled by horses. The Israelites had none, but nonetheless, Israel beat them despite those 900 iron chariots, which means not they were made out of iron, but that they had iron blades sticking out of the axles to slice up the enemy. Doesn't matter. Israel beat them. We go now to Judges 5:23. Deborah continues, curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord, utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the warriors. Now, who is this Meroz? It's obscure. It could mean Sisera's star. It could be a mighty man called Meroz. It could be the name of a city where the battle was fought near. It could be the same as Merom, which is mentioned when Joshua, who he also beat Hazor and a king called Jabin, an earlier version of that city of Hazor and an earlier king named Jabin. That's in Joshua 11:5. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. And so maybe Deborah's making a poetic allusion to something that happened a long time ago in the past. I don't know. I tend to think whatever Meroz was, it was contemporary with the battle against Sisera by Barak. Said the angel of the Lord said this, curse Meroz. That's probably the angel of the covenant, i.e. Jesus. It could be Barak instead of Adam Clark. It could be an ordinary angel. I don't believe that the messenger of the Lord is Barak. I don't think so. I think he's talking about Jesus. Utterly curse its inhabitants. The phrase literally is cursed with cursing, which means utterly, to the utmost. Use the most awful execrations that you can think of to curse these people. Why? Because they did not come to the help of the Lord. Now, that's interesting. It's not that they were opposing the Lord. They didn't come to help the Lord. God has high standards, folks. I mean, you can't go around saying, well, I didn't really persecute the Christians. I didn't say anything bad about them. I just let them go, but I was too busy doing something else. Well, you didn't come to the help of the Lord, did you? It's a good application for present-day times in this age, this post-Christian age of apostasy and stupidity. Now, notice this is the angel of the Lord being told, telling Deborah, a prophetess, to curse the inhabitants of a place, a city. Some people have trouble with that. Oh, an imprecatory curse on a city? Why, a woman of God would not do that. God would not do that. You want to bet? He just did it right here. These people that have trouble with this are these people who don't understand the wrath of God and the depth of human sin. We go now to Judges 5, verses 24 through 27. Jael is most blessed of women, the wife of Heber the Kenite. She is most blessed among tent-dwelling women. He asked that Sisera asked for water. She, Jael, gave him milk. She brought him curdled milk in a majestic bowl. She reached for a tent peg, her right hand for a workman's mallet. Then she hammered Sisera. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. He collapsed. He fell. He lay down at her feet. He collapsed. He fell at her feet. Where he collapsed, there he fell, dead. Now Jael is blessed for doing the opposite of Meroz. Meroz was cursed. Jael is blessed. Meroz was cursed because Meroz didn't give any help, assuming Meroz was a city, didn't give any help to the armies of Yahweh, but Jael is blessed because she helped the armies of Yahweh. Now, we need to note this in the controversy in chapter 4, the last audio, where I discussed in a good fair amount of detail the question, was Jael a murderess or was she a hero? Did she act morally or did she act immorally? Well, I tell you this, Deborah sure didn't have any problem with Jael's actions. She said, blessed is Jael. John Gill says there's only one way to justify Jael's breach of hospitality by attributing Jael's action to an impulse of the Holy Spirit, which was necessary to destroy an implacable enemy of God. And therefore, since this was an impulse of the Holy Spirit for a particular occasion, we should not use Jael's actions as any kind of warrant for similar actions on our part. Well, I'm not worried about that. I'm not going to go out and say, well, Jael stabbed somebody through the temple with a tent peg, so I can do the same thing. Who knew? Of course not. Clark avoids the whole problem by saying that bless means to praise, to speak well of, to celebrate. So it's Jael is most praised of women because she won that. So in other words, the people are praising Jael, not God. So God is not said to sanction the assassination. Well, I think that's sucking air. I think, you know, Deborah is praising Jael because she did a good thing. She knocked off an enemy of God. Heber the Kenite, I went through great detail in chapter 4 talking about how a Kenite ended up way up there in the north when they started out being around Mount Sinai in the Gulf of Aqaba back during the time of Moses when Moses married the Kenite Zipporah. We're not going to go over that again. Now notice in verse 4 that Jael is most blessed among tent-dwelling women. Why tent-dwelling? Well, because that's where women dwell. They dwell in tents. They had their own separate apartments separate from the men, and they were homemakers in those tents, and so that makes sense. Jael gave Sisera curdled milk. Curdled milk, butter, was the food of nobles. Common people didn't have that, so she was treating him like a king before she stabbed him in the temple with a tent peg. Now, since the word collapsed is here, Clark says that Jael stunned Sisera with a hammer blow and then drove the nail through. I don't really know why that's necessary. Sisera was in a deep, exhausted sleep. I guess it could be possible that she clobbered him and he stood up and said, "Oh, what'd you hit me in the head for?" Then bang, there comes the nail. Verse 27 says that Sisera collapsed, so Gill and Clark say this sounds like Sisera tried to get up after his temple was pierced. I think that makes more sense. We can forget stunning him with a hammer blow first. I think she tried to pierce him with the temple first, and as she struck, the shock woke him up and he staggered up, and he got just up high enough before he died, and then he collapsed at Jael's feet. We go now to Judges chapter 5, 28, verse 31. Sisera's mother looked through the window. She peered through the lattice, crying out, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why don't I hear the hoofbeats of his horses?" Her wisest princesses answer her. She even answers herself. "Are they not finding and dividing the spoil, a girl or two for each warrior, the spoil of colored garments for Sisera, the spoil of an embroidered garment or two for my neck? Lord, may all your enemies perish." That's the end of Sisera's mother talking. And then verse 31, Deborah finishes off the song by saying this, "Lord, may all your enemies perish as Sisera did, but may those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its strength." And the land was peaceful 40 years. Verse 28, Sisera's mother was looking through the lattice. Remember, windows are not invented yet, so they just had lattices that had holes in the windows. You could look out through the holes and let air and light in through the holes. The holes, apparently, according to Clark, were small enough to keep men from having notes passed to the window. If you just had an open window, you could just pass a note to the woman in her secluded apartment. That might be, for example, "Oh, your husband's out on a business trip. Why don't you come out here under the moonlight and we can smooch a little bit," or something like that. And that's, you know, we got to keep the women secluded, so lattices kept doing that. But she was looking out through that lattice, and she says, "Why is my son's chariot so long in coming?" She's suspicious of misfortune. She's impatient to see Sisera in triumphant return, but he doesn't show up. Well, her handmaidens, her princesses, I don't know what a princess is, let's just say her noble ladies who were with her, they answer her and she even answers herself. So they're both talking, the princesses and the mother of Sisera, both saying, "Ah, there's a reason why he's late. He's dividing the spoil from the victory that he's won, and the spoil will include a girl or two for each warrior." And by the way, that phrase "girl or two" is literally a womb or two. That's unchaste language and indicates that the soldiers were about to spoil Jewish virgins, according to this mother of Sisera. Boy, we're getting ready for some rape. Dividing the spoil, and then some of that spoil is going to be colored garments for my son Sisera. He's going to be a big shot. Garments were a store of wealth back then in the ancient world. And, of course, the mother's going to get a embroidered garment or two for my neck. That neck could be, the ESV has it, two pieces of dyed work embroidered for the neck as spoil. It doesn't really say whose neck it is. The Holman Christian Study Bible says my neck, which would make it the neck of Sisera's mother, which I think makes more sense than being the neck of one of those wise servants or wise princesses. And so that's just a poetic troll, a hearty har-har, pagans. Your own mother is going to miss you coming back because you dared to raise up your puny little fist against Yahweh, and now look what happened to you. Instead of exulting in your triumph over the people of God, you have been smashed. Verse 31, "Lord, may all your enemies perish as Sisera did." A little imprecatory prayer there. Oh, but God would never pray that way. God's a loving God. He would never pray. Yeah, right. Happens all the time. "But may those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its strength." In other words, there's two classes of people, the enemies of God and those who love God. The enemies of God, if Deborah's prayer will be answered, and it will be, they will perish. And those who love God will be like the rising of the sun in its strength. That's pretty strong. The land was peaceful for 40 years. That would probably be peaceful from the time of this victory of Barak over Jabin. Some people say it's from the time of Ehud, which was two judges previous. Because Shamgar, the third judge that came after Ehud, was just briefly mentioned. It doesn't matter. Let's just say it's 40 years after Ehud. Again, as I've said earlier, the chronology of these judges is, and the dates cannot be too accurate, and it doesn't really matter. One last point. Last audio, chapter 4, I was talking about the feminist argument that since Deborah was a judge in Israel, why can't we have leaders today, either in the home or the church? Why can't women lead men? Horrible thought. Feminism is a disaster, and it's amazing how wussy puss evangelicals just suck up to the culture, imbibe it, drink it into their souls and their spirits, and start spewing out nonsense. But Deborah does seem like a leader. I mean, after all, she was publicly judging men. She mustered an army together. She recruited Barack. And I said that the real reason for that is not God is not really sanctioning women leadership. Is that when there's male abdication of leadership, there's no choice. Women have to operate. It's just like the law. In the law, there was lots of things that were not good. There was slavery. There was prostitution. There was polygamy. There was easy divorce. That didn't mean God sanctioned all that. It didn't mean he liked all that, but he tried to regulate it. But just because you regulate something doesn't mean it's good. Just because it's mentioned doesn't mean it's good. And Deborah was mentioned here as a judge. It didn't mean that this was God's ultimate intention. He probably meant for a man to rule Israel, to judge Israel, but such a man was not to be found. We mentioned that Deborah is never mentioned to have been called by God to be a judge like most of the other judges were. That this was a time when everyone did right in his own eyes. This is not a situation that you want to use as a normative example for how Christians ought to act today in the church. Isaiah mentions in verse 3:12, youth suppress my people, women rule over them. Boy, that sounds like America, doesn't it? At any rate, Deborah was a great woman. It's a great story in chapters 4 and 5. One thing I forgot to mention in the last audio, too, is that Deborah is not mentioned in the Faith Hall of Fame. Barack is. So that shows that we need to remember Barack in all this, too. Yes, sure, he didn't go out without Deborah. He wanted Deborah to come, and he lost his glory because a woman got the glory. But it could be that Barack didn't care who got the glory. He just wanted to win. So let's don't forget him. He is listed in the Faith Hall of Fame. Ladies and gentlemen, on that happy note, we have now finished Judges chapter 5, and we will go now to the first half, well, not now, but in our next audio, to the first part of Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 23. We'll see the Midianites start to oppress Israel, which will prepare us in verses 24 through 45. We will see Gideon destroying and building an altar and laying down a fleece. That's two audios from now. See you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.